The results are in, and Super Tuesday turned into quite a celebration for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll find out what made the difference and how close that gets Trump and Clinton to securing their party's nominations. Also, former Attorney General Terry Goddard is leading the push against so-called dark money and its impact on Arizona elections. I'll talk with Goddard about the Open and Honest Coalition, which includes the Open and Honest Disclosure Initiative. How does it attempt to let the public know who's contributing to campaigns? Plus, are humorous campaign ads beneficial to candidates, and are we going to see more of them this summer and fall? Also, a longtime education leader is moving on to a new position. I'll ask Janice Palmer about what she's expecting from the shift from the Arizona School Boards Association to the Helios Foundation. And we'll meet the National Geographic Explorer, who became the first woman to summit all of the world's 8,000-meter peaks without supplemental oxygen. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, former Attorney General Terry Goddard is leading the push against so-called dark money and its impact on Arizona elections. I'll talk with Goddard about the Open and Honest Coalition, which includes the Open and Honest Disclosure Initiative. Also, a longtime education leader is moving on to a new position. I'll ask Janice Palmer about what she's expecting from the shift from the Arizona School Boards Association to the Helios Foundation. And we'll meet the National Geographic Explorer, who became the first woman to summit all of the world's 8,000-meter peaks without supplemental oxygen. We start today's program with the results of Super Tuesday and how they'll shape the presidential campaign to come. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had very good nights. With me to talk about where that puts the campaign and what issues we should be focused on is Fred Sollop, political scientist from Northern Arizona University. Fred, good morning.
Good morning.
How competitive do you think those primaries could be, and how much is dependent on what happens on March 15th to see who in fact survives, whether Bernie Sanders is still actively running, whether Marco Rubio is still involved, whether John Kasich is still involved?
Yeah, it's an interesting race that's taking shape, and certainly last night went to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but those two candidates have established the front runner position, and that will carry them likely into Arizona. We already have strong endorsements on the Republican side in Arizona. We have Jan Brewer endorsing Donald Trump and Joe Arpaio endorsing Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is going to carry this state, even if Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio continue to be in the race. And on the Democratic side, the state, as I mentioned, did vote for Bill Clinton in his second election, presidential election, and is favorably disposed toward Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders may win some support here in the north in Coconino County with the university crowd and University of Arizona crowd in Tucson. I would expect that he would do well. But overall, I would imagine the state going for Trump and Clinton.
Fred, a lot of observers, and I suppose this happens in every primary season, are concerned that a lot of issues aren't necessarily being discussed. There's a lot of rhetoric, a lot of platitudes, that sort of thing. Do you think that Trump doing as well as he has makes it more or less likely we'll hear about specific issues and specific plans as the months go by?
Well, Trump is certainly putting issues out there that are not being put out there by other candidates. He's taken a lead, for instance, on immigration, has really defined that debate. Now other candidates are talking about immigration. Immigration is important in Arizona. So we would continue to hear that issue being put out there. I feel like we're hearing a range of issues being discussed in this election, not just immigration. We're also hearing on the Democratic side about questions about inequality and health care. And those are very strategic questions. They're very important for the Democrats. On the Republican side, we're continuing to hear about war and peace issues and certainly approaching that from a very strong military stance. That also goes along in Arizona with veterans issues. We have a very strong veterans crowd.
How important, though, is it that voters hear detailed plans? And do we not necessarily pay attention to detailed plans until we get into September and October? As you mentioned, those issues are being mentioned, but it does feel like the issues are just sort of thrown out into the stratosphere, and we're not really hearing what a candidate would do, how a candidate would work with Congress on getting things through, you know, those practical sorts of items.
Yeah, it's interesting that we are hearing these very general statements being made on the issues. And to the credit of the candidates, it's very difficult for them to lay out detailed plans. The more detailed they get, the more open they are to criticism. And frankly, if the candidates came to the voters and said, I just want to admit that as president, I really can't be that effective. I have to work with Congress. Congress is going to weigh in. They're going to moderate what I say. They're going to contradict what I say. I just can't be that effective. No one's going to vote for that candidate. So it's not an effective primary strategy.
So, Fred, I'm also wanting to talk about going forward the way that Donald Trump has surprised so many observers and has done well in states that not necessarily all that similar. Do you think, based on what we're seeing, that there are going to be enough people who are the types who want to see reform, who will then say, listen, we need to change the primary and caucus system, especially as so many people are aiming toward the 15th of March, as they're looking at some of the industrial states, some of the Midwestern states that they think are more, I'm going to say, have more conventional or more moderate voters, let's put it that way. If Donald Trump, in fact, secure the nomination, do you think we'll see at least pushes to change the primary dates, the caucus dates?
Well, we always go through a period of groaning and moaning after the primaries, and we rethink the state's rules and the timing of the calendar. That's been a perennial question in politics. And if Donald Trump wins the nomination, that issue will certainly be back on the agenda. And frankly, if Bernie Sanders won, the Democrats would rethink their calendar. But we really don't know what's ahead. It looks like Donald Trump is winning, and he's using reforms that have been put in place against the mainstream Republican Party. But interestingly enough, Donald Trump has yet to receive a majority of votes in any of these states that he won. He's getting about a third of the votes, between a third and 40-45% of the vote. So when you add the mainstream candidates together, whether it's Marco Rubio, John Kasich, even Ted Cruz, if you throw him in the mix, a majority of votes are being cast for someone other than Donald Trump. We have yet to see how this is going to play out.
Fred, you're a political scientist. You were also a longtime pollster. So I guess I'd ask you this. If you were to put out a poll right now to, let's say, likely voters in Arizona, in the whole of Arizona, not just northern Arizona, is there a question you would want to ask? Because for me, it does seem like there is a fear out there. There is a dissatisfaction. And yet, if you look at numbers, it seems like there's been a steady recovery over the past few years. It feels like people should be more optimistic. How would that play into maybe a question you'd ask potential voters?
It's a great question that you're asking, and there's a lot of media talking about the angry voter. I'm just not convinced that the voters are angry. They may be fearful about their future. They may be nervous. I think they're more aware of what's going on. They're a more well-educated electorate, and they're a more empowered electorate. So I would ask questions regarding the voters themselves. What's on their mind? And frankly, I'm just not convinced that they're angry. So I want to understand better what their motivations are. What do they see in these candidates? Why are they supporting candidate A or candidate B? What motivates them in this election?
Fred Sollett, political scientist at Northern Arizona University. Fred, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Whether it's out-of-state groups or suspected involvement by Arizona's largest utility, concern has been building among many about so-called dark money and its influence on elections. Reports have indicated that at least $25 million in dark money made its way into Arizona's 2014 campaign. One effort to require more disclosure of campaign donations is known as the Open and Honest Disclosure Initiative. It'll need more than 225,000 signatures from registered voters by July 7th to make it on November's ballot. And the man leading that effort is former Attorney General Terry Goddard, who joins me now. Terry, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So you ran for Secretary of State in 2014, and the subject of dark money came up a lot.
It was really my singular issue.
Yeah. How much were you actually hit by dark money? Did that affect whether you would have won or lost?
Well, let me put it this way. More dark money was spent than my total campaign budget against me. So it was significant, and the timing was certainly critical because it came at the very, very end of the campaign. So, you know, dark money, as you mentioned in the intro, really ran the table in Arizona in 2014. Every statewide race where dark money played a role, and in many of the primary campaigns, dark money was victorious. So I thought it was my commitment in running for Secretary of State was to stop it. I wasn't elected to do that job, but I'm still committed to trying to stop dark money in Arizona.
Well, from the time you were mayor of Phoenix, you've been into a lot of government reform initiatives. When did you determine, even when you ran for Secretary of State, how long had dark money been a concern of yours?
Well, dark money in Arizona and around the country, to the scale, I'm sure that you could point to anonymous contributions that are very hard to discern the source of a contribution in elections before 2010. But 2010 was the geological upheaval, the earthquake that changed everything, and that was the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. They didn't approve dark money. I think there's a fallacy about that out there. But what they did do was approve corporate spending in elections. And corporations grabbed that baton with abandon, with enthusiasm. And all of a sudden, the number of dollars that were being spent soared. But corporations also like to remain secret. They don't particularly like their customers or their shareholders or other folks in the community, if they're publicly traded, to know what they're doing in politics, because they know there's going to be somebody opposed to it. So they wanted to be secret. And that's where all the 501c4 efforts, the so-called nonprofit foundations, were suddenly created in order to disguise the original source of so much political money in the future. And the 2014 election in Arizona was probably the highest penetration of dark money in the country, in percentage terms.
Let's talk about the initiative you're involved in. How much money would have to be involved, Terry, to trigger this disclosure, and then who would enforce?
Well, we want to make it clear that it's not the small contributor that is creating a problem here. It's the large contributor. It's the millionaire, billionaire corporate involvement. And so we had a threshold. You've got to spend at least $10,000 on an election to trigger the disclosure requirement. And then we're looking for the original source of contributions of at least $10,000 or more. Now, that's not the small contributor, obviously. That's the big guy. And we wanted to do that both to cut down on paperwork, frankly, and to focus in on the real target, but also to diminish those people who feel that they have a right to remain silent, to hide. They don't. The Supreme Court's been adamant about that, but we wanted to make sure that no smaller contributors were caught up in this disclosure. Now, how is it enforced? The primary enforcement is to our existing state authorities. That'd be the Secretary of State and the Attorney General. But for people who are skeptical of whether or not they would be enthusiastic about enforcing an anti-dark money proposition, we also have a very robust citizens override. So the way it works is if somebody sees in a disclosure, and that has to be done within 24 hours of the expenditure, if they see what they think is a problem with the disclosure, they don't think it really reflects the original source of the money, which is required under the statute if it is approved by the voters, then they can file a complaint with the Secretary of State. If no enforcement action is taken within 10 days of that filing, then that citizen has the ability, the authority to step into the shoes of the state official and to file a suit. And if successful, we'll get attorney's fees and costs reimbursed.
So briefly, would it have complicated things too much to try to create some sort of independent commission?
Well, that's what California did. And I think the short answer to your question is yes. Because I don't see a lot of appetite in Arizona for creating new bureaucracy. So this is a sort of self-enforcing proposition. It basically puts the burden on the individual or the entity that spends the money on politics, not on the contributor, but on the spender, and says, you got to tell us where your money came from. It's that simple. And just let me say the very first phrase of the proposal that we're out to the voters right now trying to get signatures on is, we as Arizona citizens have a right to know the original source of all major contributions trying to influence an election of a candidate in the state of Arizona, either pro that candidate or against that candidate. I've always thought we had that right to know. It's fundamental to my belief about our democracy. But if this is successful, this proposition is successful, we will put that right to know in the Arizona Constitution.
Former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard will continue our discussion about dark money coming up. Also, we'll find out about possible plans for the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Arcadia. Stay with us. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, joined by former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard. We're talking about dark money. Terry, how do you get the average voter excited about dark money? Certainly people who vote all the time, who follow these issues, they're passionate, they're irritated by it. Does the average voter care as much as you wish they wish they did?
No, they don't probably care as much as I and you and others that are more active in the process. But they do care about the fundamental honesty of their system. And I think they have very serious doubts right now that the system, the deck is being dealt fairly. I see overwhelming sense that the system is against me. And no greater symbol of that is out there than that you can't say, you see a political ad and you can't say who's really behind it. You see a disclaimer as required by law, which says citizens for good things or clean air or for some other sort of innocuous purpose is the sponsor of that ad. And you know perfectly well that some billionaire in another state is probably the one that put up the money, but they're not identified. And I hear that over and over again. People are saying this leads to corruption. It leads to unseen hands manipulating my vote. And how can I cast a knowledgeable vote? And again, I hear this all the time. If I can't even say who it is that's behind these persuasive ads, that's a very powerful point. And I think it really resonates with an awful lot of people in our community.
As a former attorney general, does it bother you from a legal standpoint as well as a citizen standpoint?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, I spent most of my career as attorney general going after dark money in a different form. This was drug cartel money that was being laundered across the border back to the cartels. And the only difference in the techniques that I'm seeing here is the money that's going into politics is still perfectly legal to hide the source. Obviously, there are anti-racketeering laws which make it illegal to launder money if it happens to come from drug sales. But one of the indirect, but I think very important impacts of this proposition, if the voters sign it first and then vote for it when it's on the ballot, is that it will make it very clear that in Arizona, hiding the source of a political contribution is illegal. And therefore, if somebody's trying to game the system, somebody's trying to break up their contribution, which is really very large, into smaller pieces so they don't have to disclose, that's what we call structuring in prosecution terms. And that would be illegal, and that would be money laundering. As long as the voters of Arizona say, we want to know, we're going to make it our constitutional right to know who the source of every major political contribution is.
Now, APS was allegedly heavily involved in the 2014 elections and getting very involved on who would end up on the Corporation Commission, who would end up in the Attorney General's office as well. I'm just asking for your opinion here, again, as a resident of Arizona, as a citizen. Should we be more bothered by that speculation, the idea that maybe the major utility in the state did this, than some out-of-state group that may have been in 25 other states as well?
You know, I frankly am bothered that an offshore organization or Las Vegas water interests could be hidden in the maze of dark money. I think we have lots to worry about if we don't know who's paying for information that leads to our voting one way or the other. Sure, it's important if a local corporation is trying to manipulate us. I think that's wrong. But I also think the fact that there is this money, I'm sorry, I'm lost for words, and that's unusual. We've got an octopus out there which is hidden. And we as voters in Arizona don't know who it is, and I believe we absolutely must in order to cast knowledgeable votes. And because the efforts to obscure are so well done, and bear in mind again, nothing is illegal yet until something like our proposition is passed, everything that's done to hide your political involvement is perfectly above board and legal under our current system. I think that's obnoxious. I think that's horrible. It's got to be changed because Arizonans and people across the country are saying, we want to know. We want to know who it is that's trying to manipulate our vote. And the dirty secret behind that is it could be anybody.
And Terry, finally, you're going to face hardcore opposition on this.
Oh, boy.
And do you expect to face
well-funded opposition,
And well-funded opposition, and will we ultimately know who that opposition is?
Well, not right now. My proposition isn't in case. So although we have made a commitment that any money that goes into the Open and Honest Coalition is going to be totally disclosed, even if we don't have to, our opposition, I believe, will remain in the shadows. We have some of the most of the. This is Arizona gets some very odd distinctions sometimes, and one of our distinctions is that we are truly the center for dark money all across the country. A great deal of it has been moved through the state of Arizona through some of the political operatives here, including some working for major elected officials. That is a distinction that I'd like to do away with. I don't think we need to be number one in dark money anymore.
Former Attorney General Terry Goddard, he's leading the campaign for the Open and Honest Disclosure Initiative, which will need 225,000 signatures from registered voters by July 7th to make it on November's ballot. Terry, good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. And we could
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The battle over funding for K-12 education in Arizona has been ongoing, and voters will have a major opportunity in May to add a lot more of it to schools here. But other K-12-related issues are vital, too, including training and retaining quality teachers and having standards that make sense and help students proceed and succeed. Janice Palmer has been an active part of the education scene in Arizona for a number of years. She spent the past 15 with the Arizona School Boards Association, most recently as Director of Governmental Relations. She's finishing up there this week before taking her new job officially as Vice President with the Helios Foundation. And Janice Palmer joins me now. Janice, good morning.
Good morning.
So how dramatic a shift is it going to be from the School Boards Association to Helios?
Well, it's extraordinary ability to build what we already have from the School Boards Association and the fact that it's a membership-driven organization, and Helios Education Foundation is much more of a mission-driven organization. But we both are so fully committed that every child has the opportunity for success, that education is the driver for economic prosperity. And so it's a building block. I'll take the stories from members, whether it's St. David or Baba Quivri or Kingman, and take those stories and build upon it at Helios Education Foundation.
So Helios is involved a lot in school reform and sort of new ideas and whatnot. You'll be heavily involved in that. When we think about school reform, this is a big question, Janice, but what are a couple issues that really come to mind for you?
I think really Helios is focusing on the fact that we have over 43% of our population is Latino. And what are we going to do with that Latino success gap? How is Arizona going to be prosperous if we don't look at who our population is and provide every opportunity possible in order for success to happen? And so when we talk about reform, reform can mean a lot of different things to different people. But our sense of reform is that every child deserves the opportunity for something better, and we will do everything possible to make sure that that happens.
What changes have you seen in Arizona that make you optimistic? Because sometimes when it comes to K-12 education in Arizona, it can be difficult to be optimistic, but are you seeing things go in what you'd consider a positive direction?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is one of the most extraordinary things that we did this past fall was the passage of a settlement agreement that is now voters are going to have the opportunity on May 17th to look at Proposition 1, 2, 3, but it was extraordinary in a number of ways. And you're so right, Steve, because it's easy to get down. We've had a very difficult time. Arizona was the first in the recession, the last out, something unprecedented. But what we're doing now is building back up Arizona to be an extraordinary place that we know that it is. And what you had is diverse parties, parties like Governor Doug Ducey, Speaker of the House Gowan, President Biggs, folks that don't necessarily agree just in and of themselves, and having the education community coming together pushing, working, and coming together for a solution. And that solution, Prop 123, is I think our first step of saying we value education, but even more so, we value working together as the education business community and legislature to do right by our kids and do right by our state.
And you feel good that that won't be a one-off? That people, okay.
Absolutely not. This is a first step. And frankly, I would say this, shame on us if that is the only step, because we have a lot of work to do. And it's not only in the K-12 world, it's also in universities, community colleges. Our kids deserve to have the same opportunity I got in a public school. I'm so proud. I've been able to have so many opportunities, and I think every child should have that opportunity as well, and we're committed to making that happen.
Janice, what do you make of, there's a push in the legislature which has slowed down a bit as far as increasing vouchers and making them much more available. And there have been some that said, well, even those who agree with that philosophically are concerned with the impact that could have on Prop 123, that it almost looks contradictory. Even from perception, how did you feel about that?
You know, we've seen voucher bills a number of years. There's also been other issues that I think the education community would say is eroding public schools in an effort to promote private schools. But at that same time, again, that's why Prop 123 is so extraordinary. It's not just the solution. It's the people coming together and folks saying, okay, let's set aside what we may believe in order to do the bigger good for all of our kids, our million kids that expect a great education. And so that's what's happened. We do not expect vouchers to move forward for a full implementation. We don't expect to see some of the other efforts to erode funding to schools. And instead, what we're saying, let's be thoughtful about this. The governor created a Classrooms First Council. Let's be thoughtful. If some of these things we feel are inequitable or we want to have a different policy, let's not do it piecemeal. 123 is giving us the umbrella. Mm-hmm. Let's then move forward in a way that becomes step 4, 5, and 6.
You're someone who's been so dedicated to this for a long time. When you mentioned the 43% Latino students, it stands out to me because I feel like there are, because we have so many kids for whom English is a second language, and there have been programs, of course, how are we going to figure that out and whatnot, and Native American students as well who come from a different sort of background. That diversity in Arizona can be a great advantage, but I also wonder when it comes to K-12, can that be an additional challenge that maybe isn't factored in quite enough?
Absolutely. And that is where the experience at the School Boards Association is. I mean, I feel it in my heart, because when you are in Window Rock or you're in Baba Quivri, it almost feels like a different world sometimes, because it's not just being Native American, obviously. It's poverty. It's the social issues. It's the wraparound items that you see in a community, that when a community is not strong, usually their education system's not strong, and it all goes together. Or if you're in, you know, downtown Phoenix and you have a large number of English language learners, all of these kids are absolutely bright, smart. They just need the opportunity to succeed, and they need that opportunity in twofold. They need the resources to do it, but we also need a commitment from the state to say, education is the driver of our economy. We will not be successful if you're not successful. So we're with you. We are holding your hand, children, to make this work. And, you know, Prop 123 is starting on that place. But, you know, the School Boards Association has, with that diverse membership, we do it all the time. We have a political agenda that you would think, oh, my goodness, we would be all over the place. 95% of the issues are the same. Mm. We want to do right by our local communities, and we need the resources to do it. Let us do that and support us.
Do you think there needs to be a dramatic, creative shift in Arizona, or is it just more of a conventional commitment, as you say, making sure there's more per pupil, making sure better teachers are retained, that sort of thing? Or are we at a point where we're behind, so we really need to do something different?
Oh, my gosh. I think Arizona is just, being part of the West is that pioneer spirit, the ability to every single day show up to do the most extraordinary job that you can do. You can see it in our public schools. You can see it, my goodness, Dr. Crow and Arizona State University. I remember downtown Phoenix being very tough down Central Avenue and Van Buren. Now it is one of the most prosperous places, where you have small businesses, you see young folks, young students that are engaging in their educational efforts. We have so much great that is going on. If we can now get also policymakers and everyone on the same page, the sky's the limit for what we see in our future.
Well, Janice, finally then, I guess, what does it take? Because obviously you're someone who's, I mean, you've been at the legislature for a long time as well, being involved in government relations. And you're so optimistic and you're looking forward to all these things. But as you said, there have to be consistent dance partners for this. So I sort of come back to talking about Prop 123. For some people, that is that going to be a one-off? Is it or not? And you obviously don't think it will be. What's going to make sure it isn't, though?
That is the exact reason of going to the Helios Education Foundation. And I say that it was so much excitement because the other piece of the puzzle is also having philanthropy. We have an amazing philanthropic community in Arizona. I mean, it's amazing to see the Helios Education Foundation has invested over $170 million in Arizona and Florida over the past 10 years. Do we necessarily know about that? Are we leveraging the consistency that philanthropy can provide since they're so mission-driven? Also working with policymakers, also working with business community. I feel like this perfect storm is happening, and you're hearing it from most folks. You don't hear Prop 123 is the end-all, be-all. This has to be the first step, and we're committed to making step 4, 5, and 6.
Janice Palmer, after many years with the Arizona School Boards Association, is becoming a vice president with the Helios Foundation. Janice, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Frank Lloyd Wright's legacy has mostly been focused on the lasting power of his architecture and design, with a little personal controversy thrown in. But lately, here in the Valley, Wright's name evokes passion and frustration regarding one particular house in Phoenix's Arcadia area. That's thanks to plans that would include nighttime events and tours that some think would be too disruptive to the neighborhood. But is progress being made on that front? Mike Sunnix of the Phoenix Business Journal has written about that and joins me now. Mike, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. So what might change about this current arrangement and what entities might be involved?
Well, ASU, Arizona State University, or perhaps another university or college could step in to kind of solve this impasse between Zach Rawling, an attorney who owns the David Wright House, and some of the neighbors in that pretty affluent Arcadia area who are worried about noise. What the compromise could end up being is maybe somebody like ASU would locate some educational and architectural programs there instead of having the events that some of the neighbors and Sal DeCicco from the city council worry about so much. And both sides seem kind of open to going down this path.
That indicates people have been listening to each other, which seemed like kind of a surprise considering how they were sort of at each other's throats. Any idea what caused this momentum shift?
Well, I mean, you know, Sal represents that district, and he sides with the neighbors who are opposed to the events, and all this has to go through the city council. If the people own the house want to get historic preservation designations and any kind of special approvals from the city to host events, the council and the city at some point would have to approve that. And a lot of times, the other city council members will kind of defer to whoever's district an issue is in. So I think this. CCO had kind of an advantage on that in terms of what kind of final vote we might have seen on that. So I think that was one of the things. And look, Zach Rawling bought this house, I think it was 2012. It was going to be demolished. You know, he wants to preserve it. He's a Frank Lloyd Wright fan. And I think the way they saw to kind of make this work in terms of financially was, well, maybe we'll host some events there. And you know, we weren't talking about rowdy events. These are jazz concerts and architectural talks and art shows and stuff. But, you know, the other side was just worried about traffic and noise in a residential neighborhood. So I think there was a little middle ground to be found in terms of the ones everybody wants to preserve this house. It's one of the last ones that Frank Lloyd Wright designed. And if you have ASU come in or another school, but ASU is kind of the top of the list, then maybe you don't have all these events. You have some, you know, architecture students and architects in study there. And that seems to kind of to work out and kind of work for both sides.
Any idea what the time frame on this would be, Mike? Is this something that would happen potentially by the end of the year? I'm sure there's a lot of negotiations still to happen.
Yeah, I think we're looking at the end of the year for this. There was the city council was supposed to consider maybe today, this month, a historic preservation request from the Wright House people. They've asked that to be delayed until December. Folks have told me that you know ASU kind of has to study the feasibility of this and doing this and kind of go through all their protocols. And then it's still got to be determined, you know, do the owners that own the house now, do they donate it? Does ASU buy it? You know, what kind of tax stuff goes on with that? And so, yeah, I think we're looking at the end of the year. But they did send a letter, the Zach Ralph, the White House people, to the city, you know, asking for an extension on their historic preservation application. And they said, you know, we're really going to maybe after May kind of stop hosting events there. I think they maybe have one booking that they're going to they're committed to. But I think they're really trying to work something out that kind of works to preserve the property and but also figure out, you know, how to make things work.
Mike Sonnix of the Phoenix Business Journal. Mike, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear some funny and warm campaign ads. Yes, they exist. Stay with us. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The campaign ads are coming to TV and radio and YouTube and your voicemail box. Most of them will blend into others, and many of them will involve hardcore attacks on opponents with deep, scary voices and words and phrases that may or may not be truthful. So what about using humor in ads? It'll make voters laugh and put them at ease. Where are those? Where are those warm ads? Could we be seeing and hearing more of them? To talk about that, we turn to our old friend Brian Nissen, humorist and campaign ad creator. Brian, you've brought a few examples along with you. What stands out to you about ads like that? Are there a couple you can tell us about?
There's two main great values in humorous ads. And the first one is that they humanize people. They make you feel like that's a guy I want to have a beer with, or, okay, or in the case of Mitt Romney, you know, knock back a mineral water.
And I'm there with you, Mitt.
And I think the other thing is that they're just different and they have the opportunity to go viral. And this is definitely the case with the Jody Ernst commercial that she ran. She was running from Tom Harkin's seat in Iowa. She had very low name recognition and not very much money. And she really wasn't on the radar very much, but this commercial changed things for her.
I'm Joni Ernst. I grew up castrating hogs on an Iowa farm. So when I get to Washington, I'll know how to cut pork.
Joni Ernst, mother.
I'm Joni Ernst, and I approve this message because Washington's full of big spenders. Let's make them squeal.
It's not very often that the word castration comes up in a political ad. I'm sure others have been tempted to use it at times, but that's the first time it came up. But this changed things. Jimmy Fallon picked it up. It was on Colbert. They did their parodies on it. Suddenly she was on the map. People felt like they knew her. Humor has the ability to do that. But it's also kind of a little bit like the very tip of the investment pyramid. It's the diamonds and gems, you know. You don't want to put everything there because if you fail, you fail bad. But the benefits are obviously there.
You know, what strikes me, though, as well, is you have when we always the things have changed where we have to hear at the very end, you know, I'm so-and-so and I approve this message. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like that's the only place you actually hear a candidate's voice after, again, the dark, scary voice. That seems like a bad direction as well. You know, ideally, I think you're talking about having multiple ads, one that's really warm and fuzzy and maybe others that aren't quite so much.
Yeah, exactly. You want to have a mixed portfolio. You want to diversify. You couldn't do funny all the time. But you've got to – I think they're all in search of the holy grail is going viral. You have to have something that cuts through. Interestingly enough, Ted Cruz is probably the one – you wouldn't see him as Mr. Funny, mm-hmm. but he is the one who has had the ads that have been the most – had the most potential for going viral. They've been different. They've been humorous. They've been – you know, and then he's had his – the other part of his portfolio is much less impressive, but he's done a good job.
And let's hear a couple more. We're bringing family members in.
Yeah. Allison Lundgren Grimes, who...
not that easy to say, yeah. which is part of the ad.
Which is part of the ad, exactly. And running against someone who had extremely high name recognition, Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. So she knew that was part of the thing. And so she got her two grandmothers together to help her with this ad. And the idea is they're both sitting there at computers right next to her writing her campaign ad.
This is our granddaughter, Allison Lundgren Grimes.
It's a long name.
She's running for Secretary of State, and we're writing her TV ads.
Sorry.
She thinks businesses should have one website to get all the permits and licenses.
I got that idea from you and Grandpa in your clothing store.
Her Kentucky First program will help local businesses learn how to get state contracts.
So we keep the jobs here.
State government should either help create jobs or get out of the way.
What rhymes with Allison Lundgren Grimes?
Oh, such a long name.
And there's a second ad, which I'm not sure we're going to have time to hear, but it's the same sort of thing. I mean, it's
well, she followed one of these grandmothers died, and she followed it up with this great thing that was very touching, but then turned at the end back to harken back to this funny first ad that they did. It was great. I thought it was very, very effective. She lost, but did well with that commercial.
Now, Brian, you have a close friend slash alter ego who's generated some controversy among some others have embraced his tongue-in-cheek method. His name is Dwayne. Remind us who Dwayne is.
Yeah, Dwayne is kind of he's the leader of the mullet party. And
they're based where?
Right here in Arizona, Apache Junction.
Apache Junction.
Yeah, exactly. That's where the headquarters is. And he ran recently for Secretary of Freedom. This was funded by a 501c4, a group that wanted to get the message out there that we've got a lot of candidates that are making outrageous claims that they can never fulfill. And so we ran this Dwayne for Secretary of Freedom.
Hi, I'm Dwayne from Mullets Over America. The Mullet Party recently had its annual barbecue slash convention slash gun show at our state headquarters in Apache Junction. And there it was decided that I, Dwayne, would be a write-in candidate for the write-in job of Secretary of Freedom.
It's amazing we don't have a Secretary of Freedom yet at this point.
I still don't get it. Think about what he could do. That's everything. That's the whole ballgame.
And, Brian, just because of time limitations, there was one ad that Dwayne was in which went viral. You're talking about going viral. Yeah. Donald Trump-based ad sort of Making America Great Again. Recap that one for us.
Yeah, Make America Great Again. Took his song, and on a serious note, I mean, what it was trying to do was trying to educate the public and say, here's what this guy is saying, you know? It was seriously just an aggregation of everything that he had said. But what was hilarious is, I mean, Dwayne is sitting there contemplating a corn dog at the beginning, you know, and talking about how America's just going through these hard troubles, but Trump is going to make America great again. People could not figure this thing out, whether it was a parody or not. Now, to me, it was just unbelievable that they couldn't, but that just kind of showed you how Trump had kind of expanded the landscape where, you know, the borders between parody and reality are just not there anymore.
Humorist Brian Nissen, he makes campaign ads. He's also well known for the Citrus Valley Playhouse.
Yep.
Brian, great to see you. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Many of us have gone on some sort of a hike, and sometimes they're pretty strenuous. But the accomplishments of Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner are far beyond those 5 a.m. or weekend efforts. She became the first woman to summit all of the world's 8,000-meter peaks without supplemental oxygen. And she'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Speaker Series. Gerlinde, you've got a great passion for climbing. You even wrote a book titled Mountains in My Heart, A Passion for Climbing. Where did that come from, and how early did it start?
I started in my very young age when I was a small girl, and in the beginning it was only hiking up the mountains, and with 13 I did my first rock climbing, and so step by step it became my big passion, and I started mountaineering with the priest of my home village. He was a very enthusiastic mountaineer, and so every Sunday after the mass we went to the mountains. So I started very early, and then of course I had one time the dream I would like to try an 8,000 meter peak, a 26,000 feet peak, and with the age of 23 I went for such a high mountain, and from that moment on I was kind of infected for high mountains. Yeah, it became my big passion.
Is there a feeling you can describe for us, those of us who haven't either achieved those or haven't even necessarily thought we could accomplish it? Was there some feeling you had even hiking those smaller mountains, that just something that you could describe that you felt either mentally or emotionally or physically?
It was always a very special moment when I could move and could reach a small top. In my village, the mountains are not very high. They are very, very low. But each time when I could reach the top, I was so incredibly happy. And I had the feeling of kind of freedom, I have to say. And of course, I choose then a little bit higher mountains, a little bit more difficult. But while hiking up the mountain, I could always feel kind of stillness inside and just enjoy the beautiful nature and be outside the fresh air. All those things made me already in my childhood very happy.
How do you climb as high as you have without that supplemental oxygen? What sort of training does that require?
I have not a special training for the low oxygen pressure. So I do a lot of endurance training, backcountry skiing in winter. I do ice climbing in summer, mountain running, but also bicycling, mountain biking, road biking, swimming. I have a big variation of training, 24 to 28 hours per week. But the high altitude, the low oxygen pressure, I can't train before. I have to do a very precise acclimatizing while I approach the mountain. So that's the most important, to walk slowly in the beginning, and so the body get very well adapted to the low oxygen pressure. And of course, I have to drink really a lot to keep the blood circulation, to maintain the blood circulation. That is very, very important. And of course, it's better you are trained if you have a very strong body, so you can walk, you can climb better in high altitude than without, of course.
Well, and I would think it's also not just having a strong body. You must be so mentally strong as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think the body strength makes 50%, but 50% is your mind. Sure, I'm sure about this. So you need the real passion for those climbs, and also, of course, willpower. You need patience, but also you have to be very disciplined. You need self-reflection, calmness and serenity also in situations that seems to be hopeless. It happens sometimes. And of course, I always trust to my gut feeling. That's also very important.
Even with the mental and physical strength you have, I mean, not things are not perfect, even with all your accomplishments. Is there a dangerous experience that you had when heading to a summit? And when you had that experience, did it make you hesitate about doing it again?
Twice a very sad experience. One time it was on Taulagiri, a very beautiful 26,000 feet peak. I set my tent at around 21,000 feet, and in a certain moment during the morning, an avalanche hit my tent, and I went down. I was inside my tent. I went down. I don't know how far. And luckily, really luckily, I could come out of the tent. I survived, but two Spanish climbers, they couldn't make it out. So this was a very sad and bad experience. And we choose the tent place where everybody has set his tent so far since 50 years, but in that moment, an avalanche came down, and we know that there is always a certain rest of risk. I think it doesn't matter what we do in your daily life, you have a certain rest of risk, and of course also on the high mountains. And it took me quite a while till I could overcome this tragedy, I have to say. But at the end, I realized and I accepted that this has happened and I can't change it anymore. And the only thing I could do to be next time even more focused and I pay even more attention. I thought I pay already a lot of attention to all what I do, but it can happen. And I never thought that now I will stop to climb. Climbing, mountaineering is in my heart, and I think it will remain forever.
So what made you decide to take on K2, and how did it feel when you accomplished that peak?
Oh, K2 is a very special mountain for me because it took me 7 attempts till I could reach the top. So 6 times I tried from the south side, from the Pakistani side, without reaching the top. And after my 6th attempt, I wasn't sure to go back to the mountain, but I could feel that this beautiful mountain still resided in my heart. And so I went back again. And when I finally could do the last steps to the highest point of K2, it's still impossible for me to explain. It was such a intense moment. I could really feel a very, very deep stillness inside, and of course I was so grateful to make it up to the top, and of course to make it down together with my teammates safely to base camp. That's the most important and the highest priority.
As you said, you did this for the first time at 23, and it's been a couple of decades since then with all the accomplishments you've had. What has changed about climbing in the decades as far as preparation, as far as even equipment?
Between these decades, it changed really a lot. Now we have, when I started in the beginning, I had not really very, very warm boots. In the meanwhile, we have so good warm expedition boots. For example, I have a down suit now. My first five or six expeditions I did without down suit, for example. And then there's also, I observe a big climate change also. In the beginning, for example, we had a lot of ice couloirs to climb up, like on Broad Peak, a very beautiful 26,000 feet peak in Pakistan. And when I came back to this mountain 13 years later, this ice couloir didn't exist anymore. Can you imagine? And also the last 6-7 years, we face a lot of rock fall. This changed a lot of ice fall, the temperature gets warmer. And so, yeah, we can observe a big change. And all those things make climbing in high altitude not easier.
Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner. She'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Speaker Series. Her presentation is called K2, Danger and Desire on the Savage Mountain. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Jimmy Jenkins and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program, and thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Terry Goddard on Dark Money or Fred Soloff on Super Tuesday, please go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon or download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. This is KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.